Next curve.
Welcome. This is Leonard Lee, Managing Director of Next Curve. Thank you for joining today's Rethink webcast. In this session, we will be discussing future-proofing your organization with special guest, Roland Dicer, Director and Founder of the Center of the Future of Organization at the Drucker School of Management. For those of you who are not familiar with Next Curve, let me introduce our firm very quickly. We are a San Diego-based boutique consulting and research firm focused on providing experience-based advisory services to inspire our clients' digital future. We advise across a wide range of digital topics, drawing from the expertise and experience of our executive consultants and analysts. And today, we are very honored to be joined by Roland Dicer, who is joining us from Vienna, Austria. And as I mentioned earlier, Roland is the founder and director of the Center for the Future of Organization. I don't want to steal your thunder, Roland. Do you want to briefly introduce yourself to our audience?
Well, thank you, Leonard, for having me. You know, I'm actually indeed in Vienna, although my home is in California. The Center for the Future of Organization was created to be a think tank to deal with the key issues that large organizations face in light of digital disruption, of course. We are having few research focuses, and one of them is really how to design organizations that actually are sustainable and survive also in difficult futures that are lying ahead. I also run a consortium of about 50 or so global corporations with senior executives. We have a dialogue platform, how to shape innovation, transformation, and learning, again, in very large and complex organizations. So that's just very quickly about myself.
It's really fantastic to have you today, Roland, and we're really looking forward to this discussion. And we also have Jody Starkman joining us today as well. Jody is a principal with Next Curve, and she is also the executive director of the Innovation Resource Center for Human Resources. She brings more than 30 years of experience leading and managing transformation initiatives with Fortune companies. And she has worked with leading advisory firms such as PwC and IBM as an executive consultant, and is currently focused on the implications of digital disruption on the future of work, organizations, people, and leadership. So let's get started, shall we? We will cover the following agenda items for our session today. First, what does it mean to be a future-proof organization? We will mine Roland's mind for insight into what has changed and why business leaders today need to think about future-proofing their organizations. Second, Roland will introduce us to the 13 C's and how they contribute to the future-proofing of organizations. And finally, we will get Roland's thoughts on what is next for the organization. Let's get started with our first agenda topic. What does it mean to be future-proof? Roland, can you explain to our audience what it means to be future-proof in today's increasingly digital economy? And give us a bit of context on why it's important.
Well, you know, future-proof is a concept where we would say that we need organizations really to sustain in changing and fastly changing environments. Organizations had to be future-proof, actually, since their very existence, because if they were not, they would just have been extinguished. Let's look a little bit to the history of work. The first picture here shows really the caveman, and we have to realize that we were living in these small groups without a lot of tools or anything, really for hundreds of thousands of years. And this really created, in a way, core of what our emotional basis of human beings is. It created the core of how we perceive ourselves as communities. For a very long time, we kept this. And then only later on, when we entered civilization and, let's say, in the Renaissance, there came up artisan work, still work which was very closely related to people at home with direct contact with their tools and everything. And the next big step was moving into the industrial age. And I would make the point that we are at a similar major threshold right now, which means we're moving into this digital age, which again will make things very different. So if you look at the future of work, it's really dominated by automation. A look at the factory here compared to the factory, you know, on the picture on the left, the factory here on the right is virtually one almost without people. Now, it's kind of a good thing because who really would love to live and work in these kind of Tayloristic, super mechanized environments as we had to do in the Industrial Revolution. However, we did not arrive that easily where we are today. We had to go through quite a few turmoils society-wise to reach where we are today. And I envision a similar disruption and also a societal reconfiguration of institutions if we want to move on to the next, if you may, so golden age. And if you look here at the future of work, I currently envision really something that we would have taken away from humans, this type of monotone and repetitive work, which can easily be done by robots, freeing up people to do something which almost goes us back to the artisan culture of the Renaissance, where we are, again, and think about the maker movement and think about the enabling technologies like 3D printing and CAD design and all that kind of stuff, where we can now in small groups again produce stuff which is almost art, is handicraft and stuff like that, while the large kind of goods and services will be taken care of more by automated things. I see very much a hybrid future ahead of us. Now, having said this, to future-proof organizations, we need a certain kind of a spirit and a certain kind of a design in organizations, which is quite different than what we had in the industrial age. And yeah, I came up with this image here, that kind of starship that everybody should know, right? I found it just interesting that the name of this starship is Enterprise, which is something companies and work very much is about. And if you think about the motto that the Star Trek series had, which says, we boldly go where no one has gone before, that's exactly what's happening today. We are out there exploring avenues, we're exploring worlds, we're exploring opportunities, but we don't really know what's coming to us. We're accelerating in an exponential pace today, especially driven by technology that exposes us to situations, both in terms of economy, in terms of society and culture and politics, that are really something unknown. It's nothing reliable anymore where we can say, well, we've done it in the past, we're just going to extrapolate in the future the same thing. And in these kind of contexts, which have become quite unpredictable, which have become very surpriseful in a way. It's like the same, the Starship Enterprise comes to a new planet. What is there? It will be quite surpriseful. How can we actually prepare for such a thing? How can we design organizations that can deal with that kind of uncertainty?
But when you look at what you presented prior with the four evolutionary stages in the nature of work, are we going back to this artisan, democratized nature of work, or are we going to be going back toward one that's dictated or dominated by the division of work and this pursuit of economies of scale, which was really characteristic of the nature of work during the First Industrial Revolution?
It's kind of a concurrent thing that will have many combinations. There might be domains of work that are purely automated. There might be domains of work that are really like the artist, right, who is in itself, maybe in small artist communities, that is totally not automated, although maybe using tools and technology in order to bring ahead the products and services in a way that was not possible before, because we have now the means of production in our hand. My kid is 16 years old. He has in his room more or less a music studio. He can produce CDs. That's something which is totally impossible just a couple of decades ago. So those means of production have become totally democratized on one hand. But on the other hand, the scalability of stuff that becomes possible through automation and AI and robots is taking away much of the necessities that we have to be slaves of repetitive work. Right. So I think there's lots of combinations ahead, and we're going to see how this society is going to restructure. But if we thought about the old labor contract is, for instance, companies owning employees and employees more or less working for the company, we more and more see this disbanding. We have now much more independent agents. We have this kind of labor contracts that are temporary. We will maybe later see in our conversation that we're moving from a world where it's important to own the resources to becoming resourceful, and as an individual, maybe tapping into all kinds of resources, and that could be automation on one hand and then a network to artists on the other hand. That's how I envision somehow the future.
So things really being much more fit for purpose, you're going to use automation where it makes sense, and then you're going to have all these democratized possibilities and options for work for certain things that are a little bit more bespoke or expressive and more human, because all the things that are automated are going to be, you know, the whole idea is to have as few people involved in those types of production scenarios or those work scenarios than if you're on the artisan side of the spectrum, where those things that you're creating are more personal and expressive of your humanity or your person.
Yeah, that's right. And I see actually even, you know, kind of hybrid teams. I could I could easily see that in a certain task, you might have robots doing certain kinds of stuff, humans doing other kinds of stuff, and they really collaborate in these kinds of things. There are clearly tasks which robots and AI is so much better than any human ever can be. Think about a pharmacist, right, who currently memorizes maybe all the side effects and what medication interacts with which other. With AI, you have an automated library encyclopedia of knowledge that is in fractions of seconds can access that kind of knowledge. Maybe the pharmacist has studied for years and has to continuously educate himself. It doesn't make that much sense to base your capability on that knowledge, because this knowledge is much easier delivered and maintained by AI. The question is now, what is the future role of the pharmacist? And here is the question, is it more than the direct human relation? Is it stuff that still needs to be figured out?
I was just thinking about this concept of a hybrid state, if you will. Traditionally, organization design, leadership, practices, all the things that define really the work environment in addition to the work itself have been typically optimized for one model or another. And the challenge of operating more of a hybrid model, I would think, would be pretty significant. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. What sort of unique challenges having to develop leaders and organization design structures and talent for a more hybrid environment rather than optimizing for any particular one? What kind of additional challenges or new challenges that creates?
The challenges are actually on many levels. On one hand, if you look at the unit that you were referring to, which is the organization, which currently is still maybe controlled by leaders and within the boundaries of a specific system, these organizations probably have to become much more flexible in terms of how they collaborate within and beyond their boundaries. A colleague of mine has spoken about microorganizations and the management of microorganizations that need to be orchestrated in a way that bubble up in a way in this new economy. Because let's say this Renaissance thing can be a startup, it can be some idea, it can be an incubator who does certain kind of things. It can be individuals who are geniuses and which you may rely on. And organizations, to tap into that rich resource environment, have to develop capabilities to collaborate with those and orchestrate these microorganizations. On the other hand, there still will be, for certain tasks, think about, let's say, a steel mill, or think about mass manufacturing of certain kind of stuff, which may be highly automated, and is a very different type of organization that needs to be run. And there might be still traditional organizations that still need traditional planning, traditional hierarchies, and so on and so forth. So what we're looking at, in my opinion, is at the portfolio of organizational operating models. And these portfolio of operating models is not an either or, but it's really dependent on the specific task and the specific kind of value creation process that is linked to that specific organization. We won't see large organizations disappear. There's always this talk about, oh, now it's everything is network and everything is small and everybody is just entrepreneurial. No. We will have both concurrently, but the large, big organizations will have to shift towards a kind of a holding model where they operate these different operating models in different kind of situative ways, if this makes sense what I'm saying.
Yeah, thank you. It makes a lot of sense. And it certainly adds a layer of complexity to already challenging times.
Let me add one more thing. What I find fascinating is that it took 70 years or so to find an institutional frame set in society to deal with the consequences of industrialization. During that time, we had the ascent of political parties such as the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, labor unions, employer organizations, and so on and so forth. We had major societal conflicts, that there was world wars and so on and so forth. Just because the major fabric of the economic organization of the world has shifted towards an industrial way to do business and work. Mm-hmm. We see a similar shift today. And if you look about what is happening these days with social media and with this total horizontalization of communication, we do not have the societal infrastructure yet. We don't have the institutions yet to deal with this in an effective way. Democracy, as we know it, is an output also of the 18th century, more or less. And maybe some countries like Germany, actually democracy came only in the 20th century. Does it mean that all these kind of political configurations will survive easily in the digital age? I don't know. The question is, what is a new also political theory that we need for that kind of age that then orchestrates also the whole world of business and organizations in a different way? So it's really from the very basic, simple thing of the individual that needs to change in a way it perceives its employment contract to the organization, to the large system within everything is embedded.
Roland, you introduced the 13 C's of the future-proof organization. What are the 13 C's? We know that there are 13 of them, but what do these C's represent? How do they relate to the future-proofing of the organization?
Customer centricity, which is here in the middle, has two C's, right? And so if you count, you might get to even more. And 13 is not, you know, an absolute number. There could be less, there could be more. I stopped there for various reasons, but I came to them almost in a kind of an intuitive way myself. There's this famous saying, there are those C's like communication and courage and creativity, for instance, and collaboration. And usually it stops there. And then I was thinking, well, there is actually really more. There are a lot of capabilities and things that you need to do culturally and structure-wise and process-wise in organizations. You need to create a certain kind of culture and mindset. And funny enough, so many of them start with a C. So I was thinking, could we think about these C's a little bit more in detail? And so, you know, I aggregated them. I'm sure you can come up with even more if you are creative. Mm-hmm. And speaking about creative, creativity is one of the ones which I put here on the top. One of those C's, that organizations need to be creative and people need to be creative, and creativity is one of the last remaining competitive advantages if we're able to do it in many, many ways.
So how is the audience supposed to perceive these C's then? Are they ideas? Are they mindsets?
Well, I think they are competitive capabilities. And if you look deeper, you know, what they mean, probably becomes clearer what I mean by that. There are more than mindsets. And I think that most of what you find in here can be introduced into the DNA of an organization by certain kind of activities, policies, certain kind of processes, and can be institutionalized. So it's not something which just comes out of, oh, I like to be courageous. Is there something like courage that we can institutionalize as a kind of a trait of an organization?
Roland, I'm sure as the father of 13 or maybe 16 that I see co-creation has two C's and cross-boundary collaboration has two. And anyway, so I'm sure you love all your children, but maybe you could pick a few to highlight and talk in more detail about them. Maybe the ones that you think are most important or perhaps are most challenging.
Sure. I think that curiosity is a very important one. What is really driving you to explore the universe? What is driving you to break new grounds, to invent new things, to innovate? It's like the children. If you look at them playing when they're 2 or 3 years old, they want to really find out about everything. And that enlarges their universe. what happens very often in organizations is that they just stick to what they're doing today. They're optimizing that. They stay within the boundaries of that kind of opportunity space. And they're not actually curious anymore. And if you look at what everybody's actually really complaining about, silo culture and all the kind of stuff, people not talking to each other, divisions, functions being separated. You know, if there is no curiosity, what your neighbor function, what your customer, what your supplier is really dealing with, what his interest is, without that curiosity, you don't have any motivation really to collaborate. So I think, for instance, curiosity is a key element, and I think you have to institutionalize it as a trait, as an attribute in an organization, both on an individual level, but also on a structural organizational level.
Among organizations where maybe you've seen that done well, how do they institutionalize it? What are some of the things that an organization can do or that leadership can do to help promote that?
You have to make things visible that happen in an organization and encourage people continuously to look at things that are outside their immediate universe of attention. For instance, you're in HR. Are you only looking at HR issues, or how can I help you to be curious, meaning what is going on in sales, what is going on in IT, what is going on maybe in strategy? This kind of creating this connective tissue, and we will see connectivity is another one here, and the 13 C's, of course, are interrelated, and they build on each other. If you build these kind of connective tissue and make it visible what's going on there and understand what's the benefit of looking to the overall system instead of just your own thing, that is one way to foster curiosity. The other one is, for instance, if you institutionalize a culture of experimentation that continuously reflects on the results of this experiment and make this again visible. Today, it's happening, for instance, through incubators. It's happening through startup collaboration, all the corporate venture capital activities and things like that. And what happens very often is this thing, it just has its life on its own and nobody knows about it. You have to bring it into the discourse of the organization so everybody becomes curious what is going on in this startup here and there. How can it relate to us? So it's kind of a leadership challenge as well.
Confusion. That might be a little bit confusing for the audience. How is confusion a competitive capability? And what did you mean by it?
Well, confusion in itself is not a competitive capability, right? The competitive capability is to leverage confusion and to embrace it in a way that is not something that you just, you know, say, I don't want to be confused. I want to have everything clear. I want to have answers. I don't want to have questions. I want to have a clear path ahead of me. If this is what I want, great. And understandable, because that's what humans typically want. But alas, we are in a very exponentially changing world where confusion is nothing bad. It's something that is just a fact of reality. If you don't embrace that reality, then you are just not facing it. And if you don't face reality, you may
So this is getting comfortable with uncertainty and ambiguity and things like that.
You could say, yeah, it's comfortable with that kind of stuff, right? But there is one more to it. Confusion is also something that makes me think. If I'm confused, I'm rearranging my brain cells, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm confused, if I then exit this confusion somehow, I may exit it with new insights. So if I embrace that, it's something where I admit that my current cognitive maps can be shaken up. If I don't embrace that, I stay within my current cognitive map. So it's really letting yourself into a state where I don't know, where I don't really have an answer, where I'm seeking rather than having an answer. And that kind of is related again to the curiosity, to exposing yourself to the unknown, to exposing yourself to surprises that you don't know, right? It's more than ambiguity. It's more than that. It's a learning tool.
Well, you have a pretty amazing intuition. All of this stuff works very nicely with each other. And you mentioned before they're interrelated. I can start to see how they're interrelated and their dependencies between each. And so you start off with curiosity. Is that cornerstone of what a future-proof organization is based on?
I wouldn't say so. I don't think that there is a linear ranking of those. I just started out with them. You could easily start out with creativity. as well. For instance, you could start off with communication or with caring, interestingly.
Sure.
People ask always, why is caring there? And I'm happy to talk about this as well. But they really don't have a kind of a rank. I personally believe that curiosity is important and it's overlooked. Caring is important. It's overlooked. There are some in there everybody talks about, like customer centricity or cross-boundary collaboration, right? Or, I don't know, networking, which is communication and connectivity. Some of them are not so on the radar, like caring, maybe curiosity, critical mindset, but they all belong together, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, since you mentioned caring, can you explain that really quickly?
We need to care for others, for other perspectives. We need to care for other points of view. We need to care for other universes that exist within an organization. The universe of strategy is very different, let's say, than the universe of IT, which again is very different than the universe of HR, and which is again altogether very different than the universe of the customer, for instance. If we say, oh, we don't care, then there is not really a way to get connected. And connectivity, again, which is also one of those C's, is at the same time the essence of collaboration and the essence of building social networks. Now, there is this old saying that caring is necessary for sharing, and sharing is caring, but sharing, again, is necessary for even doing something like co-creation, which is another C here, or to collaborate, which I mentioned before. Caring is the currency of social texture, and if you don't have that, that whole texture falls apart. If you care for somebody, it resonates back to you. Right. If you don't care, other people won't care for you either. Right. It's kind of really what builds the social texture. And
it's like a currency for social engagement. It almost sets the purpose for why you would reach out to others within a network or a group or what have you, or an organization.
That's very true. Think about customer care. What does customer care really mean, right? Mm-hmm. It's not responding to complaints, right? That's too late. You are really almost anticipating certain kind of customer needs. You really deeply understand the issues that the customer faces. You're not just waiting till you get a complaint. And so this caring is something very deep and human. Which, by the way, again, would separate us from robots, because they may care in a very digital way. We care in an emotional way, in a warm way, right? So this kind of warmth is what creates the social texture. And this is also, by the way, why virtual groups only work well when they have the chance once in a while to meet and break bread and have a drink together and smell each other and touch each other. Whatever, but caring is a very deeply human kind of thing, but it is the essence of social connectivity.
I think that's powerful. Very interesting. I love that caring is a currency of social texture connection. It's a powerful statement.
Thank you, Jyoti. There was even this guy who worked on knowledge management who said, well, you cannot do knowledge management without love. And this kind of management by love, by really caring for others, is something that then allows you to share knowledge. Mm-hmm. If you don't care, you don't share.
Exactly.
And if you don't share, nothing happens in the organization. The silos remain.
Absolutely.
And back to the silos, right?
Okay. Absolutely. Yep. Glad you asked that one, Leonard.
Yeah, well, he has an amazing intuition to come up with something like this so quickly. Wonderful. It's very profound. It is. At the beginning, you made it almost seem like that this is a result of an ad hoc, off-the-cuff type of effort, but it's not. As we have this discussion, you can really get a sense of the depth of thinking and association that you've applied to arrive at these 13. It's impressive.
Let me say one more, maybe to critical mindset, which is not caring, because caring is more on the truly emotional side, on the social side, whereas the critical mindset is something more cognitive. Critical mindset is also a very important C, which very often is underestimated in organizations, because if you don't have a critical mindset, you're not able to transcend existing, let's say, structures, mechanisms, existing things how they are. Because to criticize them is really to transcend them and to see alternate worlds or see alternate possibilities. If we don't learn to see what is right, what is wrong, what could be different, what could be possibilities, and this is what a critical mindset is about, then we also stay just in our existing domain of thinking. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's another one. Critical mindset is necessary to develop new products.
Yeah.
Critical mindset sees the failure or the weaknesses in certain kind of value chains and whatever. You need that mindset to analyze what's going right and what's going wrong.
Why don't we move on to our next topic here, which is what's next for the organization? Where do you see the organization going as the digital economy continues to progress and evolve and the organization rides this continuum of change that is the global digital economy?
I clearly see something like disorganizing happening in the traditional sense of organization, which means we're going to see, as I mentioned before, all kinds of varieties of organizational operating models. So the key driver and the key shift, in my opinion, is that we're leaving the organization as a kind of one set structure and system, and it becomes a much more extended enterprise, which becomes important. You know, the business ecosystem becomes important as the unit of analysis and the unit that needs to be led. In the past, we led as a senior leader an organization within the boundaries of this organization, and all the other stuff was external world. In an age of platforms and an age of where you need to collaborate, co-create, and co-compete with stakeholders that are not necessarily inside your organization, but many of those important stakeholders are also outside your organization. And if you have to be resourceful instead of just owning these resources, the capability becomes really to orchestrate your extended ecosystem as a business and not so much just to manage your own organization. So the Center for the Future of Organization doesn't have an S at the end because it's not about organizations, it's about organization as a principle, how we structure collaboration, culture, society, and so on and so forth. So for me, an ecosystem of a business is also organized in a way. So it is an organization. So we have to let go from the concept of this unit, the organization, which is, I don't know, a legal entity. You know, you belong to it, you don't belong to it.
Right.
And you belong to it by employment contract, and you don't belong to it once you're fired. That will change. I think you still belong to it. If you don't belong to it, if you are, for instance, an important resource for that organization, you still may contribute to it. There are the micro-organizations around where people self-organize around little things, but they won't survive without the big, big organizational infrastructure that assures the functioning of society as well. So I don't see only networks, but I also don't see only large organizations. We mentioned this, I think, in the very beginning of our conversation.
Right.
So that's the main thing. So another one, which I feel is really important, that we are moving from long-lasting organizations to lightweight and short-lived organizations. And when we talk about the future-proof organization, it's maybe also a model where I'm able to deal with the life and death of organizations within my own organizational universe. Mm-hmm. I have to let go of certain ones in order to survive. I have to accept they might be just temporary there and then something else comes in their place. We have a much more, how should I say, fluent model of organization that I have to embrace as well than the one where I say, well, GE has been since 150 years in the Dow, right? And then recently was kicked out. But, you know, that the model of sustainability is sustaining the same model of organizations. That's not going to happen.
Roland, this has been a great discussion. And for our audience, what are the five things that you would want them to take away from this discussion? And I've teed up the first one here that you've shared with us. Embrace confusion, expose yourself to the unknown.
I think that's an important one. And the reason why it's so important is because it's so hard. It's easy to say, I don't want to be confused. I don't want to have the unknown. I stick to that, what I know. But if I do that, I'm stuck in old business models. I'm stuck in old paradigms, right. And I'm not moving on. So I think this is the important one, but it's hard. Okay. Shape contexts that enable creativity, collaboration, and self-organization. As everybody knows, in a way, that's important, creativity. It's important to collaborate and to self-organize, but we need also context in which people are able to do that. And many of the large bureaucracy and bureaucratic organizations are not providing a culture and an environment in which creativity, collaboration, and self-organization can thrive. So I think, how can, as a senior leader, shape a context that does that? And it's already in the word enabling. It's not that I can command creativity. I can command collaboration or self-organization. Creativity, collaboration, and self-organization are not things you can command. They have to be enabled, and people have to take them, and they have to lift them themselves. If I tell you self-organize as a command, and I don't provide the environment for that, then it never works. So what are the contexts that can help you to do that? And I think we come back actually to creativity, because even shaping a context like this is a creative act. Leverage boundaries as spaces for collaborative learning. I believe that boundaries are very, very important elements of every organization, may it be boundaries between departments, functions, but also the external boundaries to customers, to suppliers, and so on and so forth. It's where these encounters happen between those organizational units. It's where collaborative learning happens, and you have to look at those boundaries and how you design them. Networks within and beyond your organization goes somehow with transcending those boundaries that we spoke before, and it also relates to the one above, the number two, with collaboration and self-organization. We have a tendency in the organization of the 20th century of vertical accountability. We need to introduce horizontal accountability as well, without giving up the vertical, of course. But fostering networks is one thing that really helps to make an organization fluid. You have to understand what is your business ecosystem. That's the first big step, because many organizations stay within their perspective. They don't even see customers as part of a system. They see them just as a target. And then once you understand your ecosystem, you have to actively shape it. And this is what true industry leadership means. It's not competing within that ecosystem for advantages, but it's shaping it in a way that benefits the overall system, and you become a kind of a leader by enabling that system to thrive.
I think these takeaways are all, each on their own, extremely important. And I'm just wondering, as you look at them and you think about them, and you think about the organizations that you know and that you work with, where's the biggest challenge right now? Which of these represents maybe the biggest shift, and therefore there's a gap in where leadership capabilities lie?
I think if you do number five well, then you're really transforming the way you operate. And it's hard to do, because you don't control the ecosystem the way you control your own organization. Within your own organization, you have a command and control authority, which is the basis of the 20th century type of operating model. In an ecosystem, you cannot command and control. You've got to influence, you've got to provide value creating platforms and things like that. That's something leaders are not used to do. It's a mix of service leadership in ecosystems and being still driving a certain charge. It's not only about servicing. That wouldn't be enough. And that's a delicate balance. It's a very delicate political capability that you have to have here. But I think that's the one. If you do this well, like companies like Apple, they know very well how to create, shape, and leverage a business ecosystem that they created. And that's the one I would point out.
Great. Thank you.
Roland, thank you so much for your insights and your thoughts for our audience. And it was great having you today. These are great takeaways. I think they're going to be very valuable for business leaders as well as technology leaders that are looking at their organizations trying to figure out how they fit into the whole digital puzzle. If you would like to find out more about NextCurve's points of view on this and other digital topics of the day, go to our website. It's www.next-curve.com. You will find research notes, media, and replays of this and other webinars on our site. To keep up to date on all the great stuff we're doing at NextCurve, follow us on our website by subscribing. We also are on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and friend us on Twitter to get live feeds and coverage of industry conferences that we attend and special NextCurve events such as this. Roland, do you want to share with us some of the fantastic work you're doing at the Center for the Future of Organization and ECLF?
We're at the Center for Future of Organization. We're doing some research on issues that relate to the digital future, as mentioned before. So one project we recently wrapped up and closed was looking at the challenges organizations face in the light of digital transformation. This was kindly funded by IRC for HR, which Jody actually here is representing in the webcast as well. We did in-depth interviews with about 30 very senior executives from global corporations to look how they view digital transformation from their various functional perspectives. Another thing, we are focusing on an index, how organizations leverage social media for competitive advantage. We have developed an index for organizational social media literacy, which is something quite exciting as well. And we're in the process of establishing a dialogue platform on exactly these issues among senior leaders in large organizations as well. The ECLF is another thing I actually currently do. We have here a consortium of about 50 or 60 global corporations where we discuss key issues that relate to the large-scale learning challenges these big organizations face, very much along the 13 C's we have discussed before. You can also check out the activities there. We've got conferences and working groups and all kinds of stuff going on in this ECLF platform.
Well, thanks for sharing, Roland. If you would like to contact NextCurve to find out more about our digital transformation services, please contact me by email or telephone for a scoping discussion. And you can contact Roland if you would like to find out more about the great things that he's doing with the Center for the Future of Organization and ECLF. And with that, thank you everyone for attending. I also want to once again thank Roland Dicer for joining us today and Jody for some great contributions to today's discussion.
Well, I have to thank you guys. It was a pleasure to be with you and thank you for giving me this platform to share a few thoughts.
Visit us at www.next-curve.com.